Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We're going to talk about extraterrestrial bases on the Earth in relationship to the Meyer case this evening. I want to start out by talking about when the Pleiaren left the Earth. In 1995, the Pleiaren left the Earth. And that's about the time they revealed their true identities. Before then, they were known by most people as the Pleiadians. But they're not from our Pleiades. They're from a star system about 80 light years beyond our Pleiades in a different space and time configuration. Now, between 1975 and 1986, during that 11-year period, they had bases in North America, bases in Asia, bases in Switzerland. They closed down those bases and left. During that 11-year period, though, there were 2,862 extraterrestrial peoples on the Earth. They were from 12 different races. They came from the Lyrian star system. The brightest star in the Lyrian star system is Vega. They also came from nearby star systems. For example, our closest star system is Alpha Centauri. Alpha Centauri consists of three stars. It's a trinary system, Alpha Centauri A, Alpha Centauri B, Alpha Centauri C, which is often called Proxima Centauri. It's a very faint red dwarf star. So, and I believe there were people from Alpha Centauri here as well. And, of course, people from the Pleiaren system. Now, in addition to the bases in Switzerland and North America and Asia, there has been a base here on the Earth for quite some time in Mount Shasta. The base in Mount Shasta is the base of a group of people called the Hyperboreans. Now, the base in Mount Shasta is more like a small city, or it was. I'm not even sure if they're still there, to tell you the truth. They were an extraterrestrial race that had been on the Earth for about 180,000 to 190,000 years. Sometimes you can see their golden-colored spacecraft coming, I think it's coming out of the eastern slope of Mount Shasta. The Hyperboreans are a blonde people. They have high technology, and sometimes they use these beam weapons to sometimes stun Earth humans that get a little too close. Before the pole shift, there was a pole shift on the Earth about 11,500 years ago. Before the pole shift, the area near the North Pole was called Hyperborea. Now, the Nazis knew that this was an area of high technology and advanced people. Ironically, that's where Florida existed during that time. Now, Florida now is in the south. Florida was in the north area at this time, and there was an incredibly good climate there. It was very warm, very desirable place. Hyperborea was conquered by a man named Eris the Barbarian about 113,000 years ago. Now, Eris the Barbarian was a king of wisdom in Ishwish. His area of wisdom was not in the spiritual teaching, but more technical things. And he had a very barbaric disposition. That's why they call him Eris the Barbarian. And he conquered the northern regions. He conquered Hyperborea. His son split off, Eris II, and conquered India. In fact, in ancient times, India was called Aran, A-R-I-E-N. It was kind of named after Eris the Barbarian's son, Eris the Second. Now, I mentioned briefly that Eris the Barbarian came to the Earth or returned to the Earth from Beta Centauri. Now, Beta Centauri should not be confused with Alpha Centauri B. Remember, I just described the nearest star system to Earth, Alpha Centauri A, B, and C. It's a trinary star system. Well, Beta Centauri is also a trinary star system, but it's quite a distance from Earth. It's about 350 light years from the Earth. And Beta Centauri, again, is where Eris the Barbarian came from. Hadar is the term used for Beta Centauri in ancient Arabic. And it's interesting that Hadar comes from the Arabic root, which means to be present or to be on the ground or to be settled and civilized, settled in a civilized area. Now, why would these ancient people refer to a star using a term that meant on the ground, unless visitors actually came from there? So Florida was located in these northern regions before the pole shift, before the upset of the Earth's axis. And the area in and around Florida was located in the far north in ancient times, and it was called Hyperborea. Now, Eris was the guy, the king of wisdom, who was not so spiritual, who conquered Hyperborea in ancient times. His son, Eris II, split off, conquered India. And then many, many generations later, one of the other sons of Eris, Eris the 11th, was murdered by his own third-born son named Jehovan. Jehovan is mentioned in Contact Report 70 as one of the rulers in the line of the Giza intelligences. Now, I briefly mentioned Mount Shasta and the Hyperboreans, but I should also talk about another group that was on the Earth in and around this time called the Hastars. The Hastars had a base in the North Atlantic for a while, and the Plarion actually built this base. The Hastars are from a very distant galaxy, hundreds of light years away. They're about 1,700 years ahead of us in development, and they can tolerate being in the presence of Earth humans. Now, there's a discrepancy in our vibratory rate, for lack of a better word. The Plarion cannot be within 90 feet of a typical Earth human, where they have to wear this protective gear. They have to use technology to shield them from our auric stench, so to speak, our negative vibrations, which are constantly going out. Okay, who are these Hastars? They had an undersea base in the North Atlantic for a while. The Hastars were a group brought here to study Earth humans. They were brought here by the Plarion. So in any case, I just wanted to cover quickly those different groups that have been here and have left. Many of them have left. From what I hear from the people of Switzerland, that most of all these groups had left. Now, I was talking about the Hyperboreans. They also, for a while, had underground bases near the Aleutian Islands and in Alaska. And they had been here for 180,000 to 190,000 years. And they're related somehow to the white human race. And the Hyperboreans had a king of wisdom who gave Henoch his great wisdom. And this Ishwish also commissioned Noah to build the ark. Now, none of the large animals, the four-legged animals, could have ever come down from the tip of Mount Ararat. So this flood that occurred actually about 100,000 years ago, when Noah, who was during that time, Noah was called Noah Kadmesser. Eventually, over time, his name was shortened to Noah, and he was working with an extraterrestrial Ishwish who was warning him about this flood. Well, the extraterrestrial eventually was turned into God, so to speak. So that's how that story was passed down. And Noah was about 10 feet tall, actually. And he worked with his extraterrestrial to build this ark and eventually saved him and a certain number of animals during this great flood, which occurred about 98,000 years ago. And this story is told in a little more detail in Contact Report 248. It's interesting, you have to pull out bits and pieces from these contact reports. It's very interesting. They don't generally put all the information in one place. Let me read what Billy has to say here. Of course, I will also do that now. Now, I once again have something concerning the Bible, and specifically with regard to the so-called Noah's Ark, which was actually built at one time. However, a completely different time than that was which is claimed by the Bible. The biblical flood did not happen at that time, claimed by the Bible, but in the year 4613 BC, and was brought about by the destroyer. Quetzal made the following statement. 4613 BC, the destroyer falls into the Earth's orbit, which disturbs the Earth in its rotation. The destroyer, if you haven't heard this before, is a comet that used to come through our solar system on a somewhat erratic interval, but still on an interval. Anyway, the destroyer would trigger immense earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, elementary storms, and from the whole event, the biblical flood arises. The rotation of the earth has changed. A pole shift often would happen when the destroyer comet come through. The biblical flood, therefore, confirmed with reality, even though it has been placed in another time by the chroniclers. As this also applies to the fabrication and the events surrounding Noah's Ark. This was actually built 98,400 years earlier, and hence around 100,000 years ago, calculated back from today. So Noah's Ark, according to modern material, was built about 100,000 years ago. Mount Ararat is located in eastern Turkey on the Russian-Turkish-Iranian border. And the Ark landed about 100,000 years ago. And not on the peak of Ararat, or none of those animals could have gotten down anyway. Anyway, that's the part of the story. And you can see how the information was passed down through years and years, and things got changed by word of mouth, and the stories got changed, and what we have now is just a kind of a mishmash of partial truths here and there. At least when I read the Meyer material, I get a logical sequence of events that can be followed in a little easier way. So anyway, I thought that would be an interesting thing to review quickly. I do have a little clip here. It's really off topic per se. It's a little interesting clip about traveling to Alpha Centauri. Again, not to confuse the two, Eris was from Beta Centauri, not Alpha Centauri. And Beta Centauri is at quite a distance from the Earth, about 350 light years away, in fact, where Alpha Centauri is the closest star system to Earth. And someday, hopefully within our near future, we'll be able to travel to a place like that. And it's interesting, if you're traveling close to the speed of light in a conventional fashion, time will slow down for you. So if we were traveling near the speed of light, we could get to Alpha Centauri within 45 days. But the people on the Earth would have experienced the passage of many, many years in relationship to us. So anyway, let's listen to what this clip has to say.
Verge of discovering an Earth-sized planet around one of the two stars in the Alpha Centauri system, the Sun's nearest neighbor. It would be a more compelling reason than ever before to explore the exotic science of high-speed space voyages and the time travel that goes with them.
Alpha Centauri is very exciting because it now appears from a variety of different computer simulations that it's quite possible that there could be terrestrial mass planets orbiting both components of the Alpha Centauri binary system.
Alpha Centauri A and B are so distant they look like a single star from Earth, but they're actually a binary pair. A third member of the system is Proxima Centauri, a red dwarf loosely bound to the main pair.
If you're sitting on a planet in the Alpha Centauri A system or the Alpha Centauri B system, Proxima Centauri wouldn't even be visible in your night sky. It's that dim.
Alpha Centauri A and B orbit around each other. At their closest point, they're about 20% farther than the distance from the Sun to Saturn. At their farthest, they're 20% more distant than the Sun is from Neptune. Each has a habitable zone similar to the Sun, where life-bearing planets could exist. And that, after all, is a holy grail in astronomy.
Well, a trip to the nearest stars, for example, Alpha Centauri, that we can do within our lifetimes would be immensely exciting. One of the great goals of science is to find life elsewhere in the universe. What better place to start, other than our solar system, than the nearest star?
But now, space travel becomes time travel, as we set our sights on a mission that can be done under the laws of physics we know now. A mission that can cross more than 4 light years of space in just 45 days. Our quest to unravel the mysteries of time now point us again to Alpha Centauri, the Sun's closest neighbor. It is the most likely first destination for a starship from Earth, a starship whose mission cannot avoid a component of time travel.
We have no idea what kind of technology would actually take us from here to Alpha Centauri and back. Therefore, we might as well be optimistic and say that we just move at 99.99% the speed of light all the way there and then all the way back.
The ship seems surprisingly small for one that has to make such a long trip. How can it hold enough supplies to support a crew for the duration? It can, because it is not only a starship, it is also a time machine.
It would take about 8.6 years, because Alpha Centauri is 4.3 light years away. But to the people on the ship, it would take less than 2 months. It would take about 45 days, because they're traveling close to the speed of light.
The astronauts would also have to overcome the problem of killer acceleration in quickly reaching the speed of light. Otherwise, they'd have to speed up slowly, adding time to the total trip. Alpha Centauri is the go-to destination for Earthbound beings hoping for a toehold in star travel. It's no accident that James Cameron chose it as home to his fictional moon Pandora in the movie Avatar.
Well, that's something I didn't realize, that the moon Pandora was set in the stage of Alpha Centauri. I didn't realize that popular movie was related to Alpha Centauri in any way. I was talking about the other extraterrestrial group that had a base in the North Sea. The people, they called them the Hasters from the planet Hastar in a galaxy some 483 million light years from Earth, a distance I can't even imagine. They are about 1,100 years in development above, past the Earth. The Plarian described the people of Hastar as very peaceful and loving. And they also live in what's called our time level. They live in the same time level as the soul system. So the Hasters, they're very interested in life forms in the remote vastness of the universe. But they didn't have the technology to travel 483 million light years. I can't imagine that distance again. But the Plarian do. In the Great Spacer, they can jump. They have a way of turning the ship and everything inside the ship into fine matter, leaving our material belt in the universe. Remember, there are seven belts in the universe. They leave the material belt and move into an outer belt, the next belt out from our material belt, where time is very different, and they can travel instantaneously long distances and then rematerialize in our material belt. Now, the strange part, one of the many strange parts of learning about our universe, is that there are different space-time configurations. You hear the term dimension thrown around a lot. So there are different time levels in the material belt. Can't claim to understand all that. But anyway, the Plarian brought these people from this other galaxy to the Earth. They built a station in the depths of the North Sea. The consciousness-related development of the Hasters was very high. Now, because they're closer to our level of development, it says here that the Hastar inhabitants cannot remain in the direct range of the vibrations of Earth people for more than 17 hours. Otherwise, they begin to lose control of themselves. Now, 17 hours is pretty long compared to the Plarian, who cannot stay or tolerate our vibrations for very long at all. We have kind of an auric stench, you might say. The Meyer material, there's so much information in the Meyer material. It's incredible. I love to go back over this stuff. I feel like I clarify things in my own understanding each time I go back through this information. I hope you feel the same. Edward Albert Meyer is a man in his late 70s. He lives in a tiny mountain village. It's called Hinterschmidruti. His first contacts began with a man named Svoth. Svoth saved Billy's life. When Billy was 6 months old, he had contracted a very horrible pneumonia and was in a coma and was not going to make it through the night. A doctor told his parents he wouldn't make it through the night. In fact, he did with Svoth's intervention. About 4-plus years later, Svoth started to send these telepathic messages to young Edward Albert Meyer. And the purpose of the contacts between Svoth and Billy was to start to prepare him for his mission on the Earth. But even before his first contacts with Svoth, Billy started to experience these impulses that I've talked about before, these signals which come from the universal consciousness. Billy woke up at about 3 a.m. one morning on a mild night in May 1941. He went outside and sat down on a bench he looked up at a beautiful starry night, and he heard a voice in his head which said, "My life is made out of the love of creation." And Billy had these strange longing for these vast distances and faraway worlds. And he was penetrated by memories of previous life experiences. And he was filled with good feelings. A little four-year-old boy here having this very profound thoughts. And he knew what space and time signify concerning the evolution of human beings. Very profound information for a young boy. You know, Billy, after he had met with Thoth a few times, was said to have the mental capacity of a 35-year-old man, and that Billy would be sought out by adults in his region there in Bulak, Switzerland, just to be around him, just to talk with him, because Billy's demeanor was very meditative, and I imagine it was pleasant to be around this young boy who had this great insight. Anyway, there's this article, it's called How It All Began. If you Google How It All Began, or if you look on the Future of Mankind site, you should find it. It's a very profound bit of writing. Let me read one sentence here. "I recognize that the light which the stars emitted was a light in the visible spectrum. However, the light of true love remained invisible and for all great times." The question comes, what is true love? True love has its basis in reality, not belief. True love is a wisdom-conditioned love that comes from observation, from an understanding that we are related to all things. And the Meyer material puts it this way, that the infinite love of creation connects all life, because within all life, that love lies hidden. Let me read here what Billy says about love. Billy says that the Earth human being has not evolved enough to be able to create true wisdom-based love within himself or herself. Only a few human beings on Earth are on the threshold of this highest form of wisdom creation love. The majority still lives in the lower forms of false affective love. Is it any wonder, then, that so much goes wrong on this planet, if the very growth medium for our evolution is inadequate? Fortunately, with enough striving and effort, we can actually begin to learn what love really is by observing the difference between genuine love and false love. False love is predominantly practiced on our planet. Wisdom-conditioned love is a harmonious state of absolute connectedness in all things, in indestructible form, without temporal limits. And Billy explains that this is a huge contrast to false love. He says that wisdom conditioned, genuine love is a wellspring of eternal consistency, which is absolutely independent of the human being's age, appearance, or personality. With a false form of love, however, factors like age, appearance, personality do play an important role. Also, factors like wealth, profession, societal position, all these things are factors that play into the false emotion-based false form of love. Now, remember when we talk about emotions, emotions rise up suddenly. You cannot steer emotions. They're out of control. Now, what you can steer are your thoughts. and your feelings follow your thoughts. So if you steer your feelings, you can also steer, I mean, if you steer your thoughts, you can also steer your feelings. However, this love, this false love, is an emotion-based love. It's a false form of love, and it is subject to enormous fluctuations in its intensity, and can thus suffer changes, and it will even transform at times into hatred and rage. Billy's deeper explanations of these two types of love, the genuine, effective love, and the false, affective love, are extremely important. They can help us analyze our lives. It can help us analyze our relationship to others. So that is the two types of love. Now, the real love, the true love that the creation radiates, the Meyer information puts it like this, that the infinite love of creation connects all life. The incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation. Creation radiates love. Love is the first creational natural law. It's not affective love. It's not a fluctuating love that is dependent on wealth and appearance and societal position and can turn into rage or hatred. But real love, effective love, wisdom-conditioned love, recognize that we're connected to all things. Love is the highest principle in creation. Everything follows that principle through absolute logic. Only man, with his free will, can turn away from love. Every tiny plant, every tiny animal fulfills its purpose in love. It's interesting, the more you study nature, the more you open yourself up so you can experience what's called empfinding, which is a fine, sensitive feeling, the perceptive ability to start knowing and understanding what love is. Let's hear what Billy has to say. Love is not situated in the heart and not the power of a god. Billy explains that true love is a conglomerated form of fine spiritual perception and finding, and is not built on emotions, because it is fine spiritual, fine fluidal perception itself. So true love comes from this fine spiritual perception of reality. Such a perception of reality comes from the respectful, concentrated observation and registering of that which it is. Now, remember I said observation. A neutral, positive observation. Remember what we learned from the might of the thoughts, that good thoughts, neutral positive thoughts, lead to good feelings, neutral positive feelings, which lead to good circumstances in your life. So, by the same token, is negative feelings lead to, or negative thoughts lead to negative feelings, which lead to negative habits and negative circumstances in your life. So if you can focus on your thoughts and steer them in a neutral, positive way, you can understand this perception of reality. You can achieve the respectful, concentrated observing and the registering of all that is. So let's again see what Billy has to say here. So the knowledge and wisdom acquired this way, through meditative concentration on the reality of a thing, results in the experience of love. But he goes on to say that Earth humans rarely possess this kind of concentrated observation. We live in a time called the third millennium. And in the third millennium, people are becoming indolent, obtuse, indifferent. And this is not by chance. There is a concentrated effort by the secret dark order to dumb people down, to provide as much distraction as possible, so that the secret order, as it's called in the Goblet of Truth, can gain control over the money, over the resources, and eventually put a chip in us and control the earth. And we've talked about in Contact 251 the rise of the robotic people who will have their arms and legs intentionally removed and attached to machines. So we are a insane society rushing headlong to our own destruction. And only a complete change of our consciousness. And there's a great teaching letter. It's called Love Letter Number 27, that says the love of creation is everywhere, because without it, nothing at all would be able to exist. Remember, the infinite love of creation connects all life. And there's this beautiful passage in the Goblet of Truth that's entitled What the Truth Knows to Say. And it says something to the effect that rivers, lakes, streams, stones, bushes, trees, animals, plants, everything that crawls and flies on the earth is a life form with a spirit form. And these spirit forms are on a journey through time that involve many, many lifetimes. And death is just the passage to rebirth into the world of pure spirit. And many of these creatures, they're connected by psychic vibrations, the swinging waves, the electromagnetic swinging waves that go from the spiritual consciousness into the material consciousness. Now, these creatures that I'm telling you about, the birds, for example, watch them fly as a unit and they turn, hundreds of them can turn instantly. They're connected by these swinging waves. Remember, the infinite love of creation connects all life. And if I listened to an interesting recording of crickets not long ago, where if you slow the crickets down, it sounds almost like a chorus of human voices just singing. And the individual should be aware that he exists only through the love of creation, and that he carries this love within himself. And all of nature in its indescribable splendor is nothing but the love of creation that's expressed visibly. So we here on the earth have to once again get the ability to observe, the ability to be neutral positive, the ability to steer and guide our thoughts so that we can have self-responsibility and we can understand what true love is. Billy has stated that the recognition and fulfillment of responsibility in regard to human beings, the worlds of plants and animals, and in regard to life, this is what the creational laws and the recommendations are all about. Billy explains that there are many different forms which love can take, which apply for the different types of life forms and between them all, and which serve the specific relations between these life forms. For example, there is a specific form of love which a human being can have for a plant. But love, as it is quite especially relates to the human being, is a capacity given to the human existence for for the development of an intensive, positively experienced relationship with a fellow human being. But you can actually have love for flora and fauna, for the plants and the animals. So, and that's of course what is missing on our world today. This kind of love, you know, part of the spiritual teachings is understanding and developing the ability to control our thoughts. And that's one of the things that we here on the earth have to try to learn to do. We need to be independent thinkers in order for to have consciousness development. And the book, The Mind of the Thoughts, is written for a people that are ill in their consciousness. And you probably don't have to go very far to find examples of humanity and why we're ill in our consciousness. One of the obvious things is that we're destroying the planet we live on. The other obvious thing is our strange compulsions and addictions. We are a people that's addicted to many, many different things. Not just drugs and alcohol, but all sorts of things. And what we want to maintain is a balance. You know, for example, if you study a tree, the trees that last the longest have an equal balance in the root system, as well as the root system is balanced with what you can see above the ground. And that's the kind of thing we have to do. We have to look at our own thinking. The evolution of the consciousness can only come about through independent thinking. And today, more and more people, we are influenced heavily by the newspaper, by the movies, by societal norms and standards. We need to be thinking and figuring things out for ourselves. And even our religions teach us to follow blindly and to not use deductive reasoning, but instead believe. No, we should be using deductive reasoning to figure things out for ourselves. You know, Billy met with Svoth until he was about, I think Billy was 16 years old when he had his last meetings with Svoth. And then his next set of meetings came with a woman named Askit. Askit was from another universe. There is a parallel universe called the Tao universe. And our universe and the Tao universe were created at the same time. Askit's people left our universe and now reside in this parallel universe to ours. And the Timmers, Askit's people, also work with the Plaiaran. And they're helping to avert certain disasters on the earth. Askit's people, the Timmers, were tasked with stopping what would have been a tremendous atomic disaster, so incredible that it would have affected the inner planets in our solar system, would have thrown them out of kilter, which would have also caused problems in other solar systems. This was a tremendous undertaking that the Timmers were involved in, and they were successful. And this occurred in the 70s. And Askit was Billy's second mentor. And one of the things she taught Billy is that the people of the earth are not yet ready to think independently, and they're not able to understand the truth. This is what Askit said. She said, "The human is still not capable of coping with and fully understanding the truth. And he is not yet mature enough to know his future and to appropriate approach it correctly. For that reason, The truth must be rewritten prophetically for him in equations in order to make him think independently. So that's why there are so many prophecies with the Meyer material, to get us to start thinking for ourselves. Now, where does this thinking occur? Well, thinking is a very complicated thing because we have conscious thoughts. We even have unconscious thoughts, which we're not aware of. We have subconscious thoughts, which we can be kind of sort of aware of sometimes. And then we have a material consciousness, which I just talked about, but also a spiritual consciousness. And the spiritual consciousness and the material consciousness, they interact to a certain degree back and forth. The psyche is the part of the material consciousness which controls the thoughts and the feelings that you're most aware of. But even the psyche cannot control what's going on in your unconscious. Emotions erupt from the unconscious, and we've got to deal with them. But they come suddenly. You can't steer them. Now, feelings are different than emotions. Feelings respond to thoughts, and they usually come gradually. Now, our consciousness is like a garden, and we need to learn to clarify thoughts in order to get a sense of peace and to remove the confusion. And that's why it's important to review things, to say things aloud, to repeat them. And some of the earlier things that I was talking about tonight were things that we've talked about before: the Hyperboreans, Atlantis and Lemuria, Beta Centauri, Alpha Centauri. These are things we had talked about before, but when you clarify these concepts, that's when you really start to understand things. And Billy says in page 20 in The Might of Thoughts, the human being must make the effort to clarify his or her thoughts so that they become more valuable. You see, these principles that you understand, they become more and more valuable to you and to others. The more they're clarified, the more they're repeated, the more you start to see the distinctions between things. Anyway, Billy goes on to say purposive and productive. These thoughts that are clarified can be more purposive and productive. And they will form your life in a more harmonious and equalized way. But he says that everything needs practice and patience. So, if we apply the following things to our thoughts, if we clarify our thoughts, if we put effort, practice, and patience into clarifying our thoughts, we can have a harmonious life. And making good decisions is hugely important to reaching a state of a harmonious life. The word confusion means a lack of understanding, uncertainty. And confusion comes from a Latin word, which means to pour together. You ever feel like things in your mind are poured together and you're just having a hard time clarifying things? Well, you need to develop these thinking skills to clarify things, repeat things aloud if you have to, analyze things, and understand that we need to be steering our thoughts. Billy goes on to say in The Might of Thoughts, when a human being starts a garden, it is started, and we know that some form of plant will be produced in it, whether it's cultivated or grossly neglected. If you neglect your consciousness, you're going to get weeds in there. These are thoughts which take on a life of their own. These are These are thoughts which can drive you crazy. Your consciousness is like a garden. If it is not correctly maintained, there will be wildly growing negative thoughts which have a confusing and destructive effect. That's how people get mental illness. Because these thoughts, they grow wildly and they can't be stopped. They can't stop thinking negative thoughts. How do you break that? One of the ways is to fall back to meditation and visualize. All meditation is visualizing. It's hard to do. If people have developed habits of letting their thoughts run wild, because emotions can feed thoughts and then thoughts run wild, what we need to do is learn to visualize in your mind. Visualize a blue sky. Breathe deeply. Exhale. Let all that negative energy out. Visualize a blue sky. Have you taken the time to sit out in nature lately? Have you taken the time to listen to the cicadas, the birds singing? Have you taken the time to relax? Next step, imagine a rolling green hill with a blue sky in the background. Just that. Do nothing else. Think about nothing else. If a thought comes in, push it out. Relax. Then imagine a yellow sun in your blue sky near the rolling green hills. You see how this builds? And the next step's up to you. You want to imagine the sun setting? Do that. Or imagine a rose, or imagine a candle flame. See, what you're doing is you're breaking these verbal thoughts. If you imagine, if you visualize creation, all your meaningless, garbage, verbal thoughts that are trashing your psyche will go away. They're not that important anyway, believe me. Because once these negative thoughts are animated, they develop a life of their own. And you don't want to let these weeds grow throughout your consciousness and destroy your psyche. And that's why people that are psychically disturbed, they can only think negative things. Because it narrows your frame of reference. If you think of the creation, the infinite love of creation connects all life. Infinite, without end, immeasurable. Look up at a beautiful starry sky. You can guess how many hundreds of billions of stars are up there. And that universal consciousness is radiating love. And you have to calm yourself down enough to be able to feel that love, to be able to sense that love. You know, we are on a ridiculously high-paced schedule today, and we have negative and wrong thoughts. And if you continue in these negative wrong thoughts, a delusional state can come forth. You know, people today are in states of delusion. And in a state of delusion, you can be knocked about by the circumstances of your life. But you know, you are the master of the circumstances in your life. You really are. That which a human being thinks, he makes real. Good and positive thoughts, if they're tended and nurtured, will lead to a good positive opinion of yourself. It will lead to self-cognition. If your life is running out of control, look at your thoughts. How do you tell if your thoughts are out of control? Are they repeating, number one? Do these thoughts make you feel bad inside? Do you feel tense? Do you feel unhappy? Are you unsatisfied? Unsatisfaction is a no-no. This causes huge problems. This stifles creativity. You know, even in the womb, the fetus thinks. Yeah, we have so much to learn about life here on the earth. And learning neutral, positive thoughts is the key to successful circumstances in your life. The human being attracts that which he is. Now, Billy has a book. It's called Arahat Athrasat. I haven't read the book. I don't even know if it's translated yet. But a portion of that book is on the Future of Mankind site. Arahat Athrasat is called the first level of the spiritual plane. It takes 60 to 80 billion years of reincarnating in a half spiritual, half material body to get to this spiritual plane. We will spend 40 to 60 million years reincarnating into a material body. And then when we get to stage 6 of evolution, we will not need a material body anymore. That first 40 to 60 million years, we're probably having all these physical reincarnations so we can learn to control our thoughts. The sooner you learn to control your thoughts, the sooner your life circumstances will change for the better. We all want better life circumstances. Well, you are the Lord and Master of your life. You have the ability to make those changes that you need to make. Correct thinking and knowledge is such a monstrous power that it is able to ceaselessly attract and bring into being everything that the human being longs for. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the show this evening. You've been listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we'll be back next weekend.